All value is subjective, but sometimes a numerical valuation is required for transactional purposes. How do you bring the objective and the subjective together? Bharat Kanodia is the expert.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We're here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We're discussing valuation today. It's valuation as in putting a valuation on an asset that two or more parties can agree on for some shared purpose. Let's do some self-examination. Is the value you've placed on your house the same for the tax man as it is for a prospective buyer? How about for your estate attorney? If you're raising capital for your business, what's the valuation you're going to use in pitching investors? Is it the same as they're offering in their deal? Is it the same as the one you use with your bank for the purpose of securing loans? The point is that valuation is subjective and variable and can be idiosyncratic. A lot of it is based on imagination of the future. Everyone's imagination is different. Someone or some mechanism is needed to bring the parties together, an agreement on a valuation that everyone can collaborate on, even if they don't entirely agree on the right or most accurate number. As we have discussed in the past when talking about contracts, in episode 121, for example, with Bill Sanders, there's a value pie to be divided up between the parties to the negotiation, and the goal is to make that pie as big as possible for all to share, and not to quibble about the accuracy of the numbers. Nevertheless, there's a great skill in being the one and operating the mechanism that arrives at the one number that everyone can agree on. The best in the world is Bharat Kanodia. Bharat has been doing this all his professional life, starting at American Appraisal Associates, and then at Silicon Valley Bank, and then as Director of Global Valuations at IHS Market. He now heads his own industry-leading company, Veristrat LLC. He loves to share his knowledge and experience with business owners, and you can find him doing that on YouTube pretty easily. And we'll give you the links to a couple of his most important videos. Bharat, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Hi, Hunter. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. We love to talk to experts, Bharat, and you are the expert in your field, which we'll call valuation. But we learn a lot more subtlety about your field as we go through this. So value is what we focus on at Economics for Business. We talk about businesses creating value, generating value, but obviously value also resides in the business itself and its assets and its processes and so on. We tend to think about business value being subjective, but your job is to put a number on it in a professional way in many cases. So that'll be the interesting element of our conversation. So I started at your LinkedIn profile, Bharat, and I could say that you started in appraisal and then moved on to valuation, but that may not be entirely right. But maybe you could talk about those two definitions, but also tell us how you got here today as the leading expert on valuation.
Absolutely. So you are right. Most people, they tend to use the words appraisal and valuations interchangeably, or they might think that appraisal is something that's informal and valuation is like a formal report. And that's not the case. Originally, appraisal is more of an American term, which is about valuations, and it tends to be more widely used when you are talking about tangible assets like commercial buildings, houses, and like machinery and equipment. But when you talk about intangibles and businesses, you tend to use the word valuation. I started my career valuing tangible assets like machinery and equipment, schools, buildings, municipalities. And a good thing is my bosses liked my work there, so they just kept pushing me to do more and more complex assets. And now I do the most complex asset of any, which are startups. So if you think about it, right, startups almost never have a profit. And they're lucky if they have revenue or even have a product. Yet they need to attract customers, they need to attract employees, and they need to attract investors. And how do they do that? They use something called valuation as a currency to attract employees, customers, and investors.
So I'm a little bit familiar with the that space. So let's get into it in a second. But I just wanted to touch on another definition before we go there, which is something you said about focusing not so much on the numbers, but the what and the why of valuation. Can you just explain what you were thinking when you talked about the what and the why?
Yeah, great question. So my first job is really to ask the why and the what, which is, let's start with the what. That, okay, what am I valuing here? Do you need me to value the business as a going concern? Do you need me to value the operating assets of the business and no liabilities? Do you need me to value just the land? Do you need me to value just the two patents that you owned? So my first job is to identify exactly what I'm valuing, because as you can imagine, each component of a business or any asset adds a whole different level of complexity and changes the valuation significantly. For example, if you were to buy a building, but you're not buying the land, you're just buying the rights to the building, well, the value will be much different with the land or without the land. So my first job is to identify what I am valuing. Second question I ask is, why do you need the valuation? You know, nobody wakes up one morning and says, I'm going to call my appraiser Bharat today and get a valuation. I don't get too many of those calls. Most people have a need on why they might need a valuation. They might be looking to sell their business. They might be looking to buy a business. They might be looking to raise capital, or they might have just raised capital, or they are looking to get an estimate on their estate taxes or gift taxes, whatever reason. So there's always a need for why one needs a valuation. And you know, that's something I need to really understand, because the same object can have multiple valuations depending on the need. So say, for example, a house might have a different valuation for insurance versus market price or assessed value for assessing property taxes. Same object. So it's very important to understand exactly what you're valuing and why you're valuing. Because if the same house is valued for, appraised for, a sale, that would include the cost of the land. Versus if it's appraised for insurance, you wouldn't include the cost of the land. So the why and the what are most important.
Well, let's go to your IPO example, Bharat. It may be a startup, I should say. I was getting ahead of myself for IPO. A startup example that maybe has got no revenue, maybe pre-market, it may be immature, it's got some revenue, and it might be expected to pivot and change its business models over time in the future. So it must be hard to put a valuation on it at that point, but you hinted at the why, which is it needs a currency. So tell us about that world of startups.
So, you know, think about two smart guys working out of their garage, and they have two laptops, and they just formed a new C Corp. What is that worth? They have an idea. You have two smart guys. You have two laptops. and they're willing to put in the hard work, what is that worth? In colloquial terms, it's worth about $1 million. Why not? Right? Everybody thinks they're a business that's non-existent, two guys in a garage with a laptop, or two laptops, sorry, is worth $1 million. And you know, we can laugh about it now, but that may not be far from reality. 10 years ago, when I would have a conversation with general partners at VC firms, two smart guys and a laptop working out of a garage is worth about $500,000. Just no revenue, nothing, but they have a general idea and the guys are credible. So them forming an entity is worth about $500,000. So if you want 20% of that entity, you're looking at about $100,000. Now, of course, times have changed. We're in 2021, past COVID, well, working through COVID, inflation, everything. Call it $1 million. So if somebody wants to buy 20% of the company, or if they need to raise about $200,000 to get a product idea or do a proof of concept, or have an MVP, 20% of the company is worth $200,000. So that's generally how it starts, right? I mean, you got to come up with some number somewhere as a starting point, right? As Mark Twain said, the secret of getting ahead is getting started. So it's almost irrelevant what that valuation is in the beginning, so long as you're getting a valuation and you are getting someone to write you a check for equity of your company. Mm-hmm. That's just a starting point. And then it starts from, hey, how do you do with that $200,000? How do you show performance? How have you gained traction? Have you shown an MVP? Have you shown a product? What does your market look like? Have you done any product testing? So, and the biggest mistake founders generally tend to do is they nickel and dime seed investors or angels on this first round. Don't worry about the first round. Just get what you're getting. And if you show traction, if you're doing well, you know, you will get more investors. And the future dilution and the future investments will take care of things. So if you are right now if you think you're getting shortchanged, and instead of giving away 20% of the company, you have to give away 30% of the company to raise $200,000, just do it. You know, just mm-hmm. get started. You know, don't worry about the 10%. Yeah, it feels kind of bad. You feel a little gypped, but show us what you got. Show us your product. Show us your traction. Show us your market demand. And if you have all those things, the 10, 20, 30% doesn't matter. I mean, it's all going to wash off when you're going to exit for $500,000,000 or $2 billion or $20 billion, whatever that number.
What about later in the stage, Bharat? I've done those things. I got an MVP. I've gone to market. I've got some recurring revenue. It's not huge yet, but I may have proof of concept. Do we get to a point where you start valuing revenues, or is it still always potential?
If a company has say a revenue of say $300,000 and they're asking for a valuation of say $30 million, that's 100x. I mean, I cannot justify a 100x valuation. It doesn't matter who you are. It's an implied valuation, but it would be very difficult for me to get to $30 million from $300,000. So even there, it's always on the potential of what that company is. At least now we know we have product traction. They're paying customers. I mean, look at Tesla. I mean, Tesla is trading at what, 1100 PE ratio? Mm-hmm. Let's put that into perspective, right? 1100 PE ratio, what does that mean? That means investors, for every $1 Tesla adds to its bottom line, investors are paying $1,100 for that $1. And why is that? Because the investors, the retail investors, the institutional investors are looking at potential future benefits or growth of Tesla. So in venture or in the startup world, you're always trying to quantify the unquantifiable future benefits. And that's why, frankly, I have a job. I mean, you know, that's something I do. And that's why I say it's such a black box, that you're trying to quantify something that's almost non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah, we use the term imagination, Bharat, which always sounds soft and fluffy, but actually it's not. If you can imagine that future for Tesla, which might be an acquisition by General Motors or by a Chinese company or by Google, for God's sake, then if you can imagine that, you can make the case and maybe somebody will buy it. So we like the concept of imagination. One of the things you said to me when we were talking last time was you see a lot of these hockey stick revenue curves. You know, we don't have much revenue now, but we're going to have this curve in the future as more consumers pile in and we add more products and services. And you said, if I got it right, you can't value the hockey stick. You got to value the operational capability to get there. So how do you do that? How do you value operations or potential operations?
If I had a nickel for every time I get a hockey stick projection, and you know, God bless the entrepreneurs, the founding team, because if they did not see the hockey stick projections, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. And that's okay. That's their job, right? Their job is to show everybody the bright city on the hill. But it may not be there today. If they can show the path of the hockey stick projections, I mean, you can't just say, oh, I mean, this is what I generally see, right? Oh, it's a $100 billion market. If we just get 1% of it. No, that's not how this works. Mm-hmm. Show me how you're going to get 1% of it. Well, we're going to do Google Market. No, show me. Tell me exactly. Tell me what your marketing campaign is going to look like. So you have to really foresee how you get there before you get there. So just by putting together projections, I mean, projections are done by my analysts who have like 22 years old. I mean, you know, you don't get money based on projections. Mm-hmm. You get money based on the story behind the projections. So the story is really most important. And that's what I mean, the narrative and the details behind the numbers that goes into it. You know, talk to us about how you're going to get there. Talk to us about the problems that you foresee. Talk to us about the wins that you would like to call as your benchmarks.
Yep. That takes us to an interesting place, Bharat, which is the value of storytelling. And this is starting to be something that's studied in the academic field and business schools and so on, that great CEOs running great companies, or in your case, you're talking about founders running startups. The story that they tell, both to convince maybe the valuer, but also to inspire the employees and inspire the investors and so on like that, is fundamental. It's very, very important. So do you value a story? Is that what you do?
Oh, absolutely. In a startup, that's exactly what I'm valuing. I am valuing a story. And that's why I say it's unquantifiable. And that's why, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said evaluation is very subjective. Most definitely is. The first thing I was taught on my first day of my professional career at American Appraisal, the valuation company I started my career at, was evaluation is a subjective opinion based on objective facts. The problem is a story isn't facts. A story is also subjective, and then it falls on the storyteller on how objective she can make that story. You know why, right? You know they always say, "Hey, give me your why." You know, why should somebody care? Why should somebody care about this product? You know, the biggest problem they have in startup world or venture capital is they have a solution and they're looking for a problem. It's like putting the cart before the horse. Mm-hmm. If you have a story, then it's almost a hedge against that problem. If you have a story, then you're talking about demand. A story is kind of a demand, a market. You're talking about the market that, okay, this is the issue, this is the problem, and this is how we solve that problem. A story is, you know, talking about the market and how you really solve that demand or the problem of the customer or the client, however you want to say it.
Yeah. And you're starting to get into emotional territory there. It's how intensely is that problem felt? How urgent is it that the customer solves it? Those kinds of things.
And this is really the true essence of storytelling, that how emotional, how personal the founder or the founding team can get while telling that story. And the more personal they get, the more an investor feels that, okay, these guys are really legit and these guys are dialed in and these guys are personally vested. So if I'm cutting a big check, that's okay, because these guys are truly personally vested. They always bank on people. I mean, you know, an idea is a dime a dozen, but it's the execution of the idea that really matters, right? I mean, for example, you've seen my videos, right? I get at least two colleagues reaching out to me, on a weekly basis, saying, hey, you do these videos. I would love to do the same videos. You know, tell me who you're working with. I always share. But what they really want to know is, what is it really costing me to make these videos? That's really what it boils down to. They don't see the effort. They don't see the writing. They don't see the content development, all the work. I mean, what you see in the videos, I mean, I have a whole found respect for people in entertainment, because what you see on the screen, that's only 10% of the work. 90% of the work is behind the scenes, and nobody wants to put that work. And that's why nobody does videos. It's difficult to do videos. It's a lot of work. You know, for a 5-minute video, I mean, my team and I, we put in at least 25 hours of work.
Yeah, and they show it. They're certainly not only well produced, but they're very persuasive. They're great stories, as you have obviously put a lot of effort into that.
Thank you.
I just want to go back to this revenue area, Bharat, because if we went to business school, we thought valuation was a discounted cash flow of future revenues. And you put that in your Excel spreadsheet and you put a formula in there. Is that still the case for more conventional businesses? I know you've got videos about how to value a CPA firm and how to value a construction firm. So do we get closer to the conventional way of valuing there or not?
When I'm valuing anything, Hunter, I am really trying to quantify three things: growth, profit, and risk. So if a firm or a company has significant growth and no profit, how could you use a discounted cash flow? If a company has profit and no growth, then you could use a discounted cash flow. Or reasonable growth, you could use a discounted cash flow. Or if the firm has, you know, if a company has exact same revenue, exact same profit year over year, then you might use something called a market approach, something they use for valuing houses. So different horses for different races. So, you know, if you're valuing a startup, you know, try using a discounted cash flow for a startup. Or hey, try using a discounted cash flow for Tesla. See if you can get to the right answer. You can. And try using the venture capital method of valuation for a grocery store. So, you know, each asset needs a different set of tools to come up with a valuation. And that's all these are: discounted cash flow, market approach, cost of risk. All these are just tools to quantify valuations.
I did see something that you wrote, I think, maybe you videoed too, about valuing patents or patents, as you would say. And that seemed to involve their monetization, you called it, the ability to generate cash flows in the future. So are we valuing imagined future cash flows there when we think about patents?
Yes, yes. So a couple of weeks ago, I got a call from a very ambitious founding team. You know, they have 8 patents, and they wanted me to value the patents because they would take my valuation and showcase to investors that hey, this is what our company is worth, and this is the amount of money we want to raise, and which is doable. I mean, I do that kind of work all the time. But when it comes to patents, patents just stand alone. They are worth some money. But if the patent is not monetized, and when I say monetized, as in you don't have any royalty source or it's not currently being used in any product, how would you come up with its valuation? It's a pie in the sky. Right. I mean, it could be anything. Pick a number, $100,000 to $1 billion. What do you do? Take an average? and I can give them a valuation. And this is exactly what I said to them. I said, look, I can give you a valuation. But they said, we need this valuation to be ironclad, so that, VCs and nobody can poke holes in it. I'm like, look, I'm quantifying potential future benefits that are unquantifiable. I'm sorry, I'm smart, but I don't have a magic eight ball. So whatever assumptions I'm going to make, it doesn't matter what assumptions I make or anybody makes, they're going to be open to scrutiny because it doesn't exist. And if something doesn't exist, it's going to be open to questions. I don't know if they understood that concept.
Yeah.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's MISES.org/E4BPod. And click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
But there are some intangibles that you've hinted at, Bharat, things like hard work and intensity of belief and those kinds of things. And one of the questions I had about intangibles is a business model an intangible? So maybe I'm a startup or maybe I'm a growth business. I've got what I think is a business model. It could certainly change. I'm going to tweak it. I'm going to adapt it to changing circumstances. Does my business model have anything to do with my valuation?
Business model has a lot to do with evaluation as long as the business model is a proven concept. It's monetized. And that's what exactly monetization is. The magnitude of monetization is irrelevant. It's the fact that it is monetized or not monetized. If it's monetized, that means you have a proof of concept. Otherwise, it's just, again, a pie in the sky. When people say, oh, they have a lot of goodwill, well, what does that mean? Just because you have a fancy logo and a fancy website and you have some big shot last name, that doesn't mean anything. It means a lot if it's followed with monetization or some followership, or you already have somebody who's written you a $5 million check and you're looking for another five. Then it means something. I had this cannabis beverage company that came to me last year. They had spent $250,000 on their branding. And branding was new logo, new packaging, new website, the whole nine yards, right? And they said, we want you to value us. And I said, okay, what's your revenue? They said $60,000. I'm like, okay, what do you think you're worth? They said about $4 million. I'm like, how did you get to $4 million? And, she was like, well, we just spent $250,000 on the logo and we have created all this brand. I'm like, what brand? I mean, just because you spent $250,000 doesn't mean you're worth $250,000. That's not the same thing. A spend is not equal to value. Take a crude example. I go and buy a $50,000 car. Well, the second I drive off the parking lot, it depreciates at least 10%. Just me buying a car doesn't mean I have created value. So and novice entrepreneurs or people who have a sense of entitlement, they tend to think that way, that, hey, just because I spent $250,000, it's worth at least $250,000. It doesn't work like that. For example, I'm working at on a chain of grocery stores right now. And right now the grocery store is taking it on the chin. But the replacement cost of each grocery store, if you look at it, is about $1 to $1.2 million. And they have about 14 of them. But the buyer is not even paying for the replacement cost because, yeah, you have all that build out, all those lease improvements, but you're not making any money. So, you know, if somebody made a mistake and has losses, that doesn't mean it's worth at least the amount of money they've spent. No, that's not how this works.
Mm-hmm. What about things like trust and reputation, Bharat? We read about how important that is to business and that it's an important intangible in generating future cash flows because consumers or customers are loyal. Let's say we have a CPA business. We've got 10 or 15 people working, so it's not just the founder or the owner. And they've got good evidence of repeat business and loyal customers. And they've got a survey about how much the customers trust and love the business and the service. Are those intangibles of trust and reputation relevant in the valuation?
Very much so. But it has to be supported with customer loyalty. So if you say that your business has a lot of trust and brand and loyalty, fantastic. Show me. Let the numbers talk. Numbers don't lie. People lie. So if you have the same customers writing you checks year over year, well, that's loyalty. That's worth a lot. But it has to be shown in the numbers. If you have to go out and find a new customer every year or every day, that's not loyalty. You don't have much of a brand, you know?
Yep. So we call that behavioral analysis. It's not the trust and reputation. It's the actual act of purchasing and paying money for the service. That reveals the emotional preferences.
Yes, very much.
One, you talked about stories, and you linked that in another conversation to another idea, which is perhaps not the typical way we think about valuations. You said, don't argue about valuations. You don't dispute it. You tell the story and don't get into the dispute about the numbers. Tell us about that.
It's a rookie mistake. People tend to think of their self-worth as what their companies are worth, especially as a new founder or first-time founder. And don't think of it that way. A valuation is really an opinion. And opinions are never a point estimate. It's always a range. I think you're a very good-looking man. Somebody might think you look like Tom Cruise, right? There's a range. Same thing with a company. Some might think, it's an okay investment. Oh, it's a good investment. Oh, I gotta make that investment. Mm-hmm. It's always a range. And you want to see, where's your sweet spot within that range? You know, I'll be here, I'll be here, I'll be here. So more times I end up giving my clients a range. And I explain to them that, hey, these are some of my key assumptions. If we go at the tail of the assumption, then this is your value. If you go at the high end of the assumption, this is your value. And smart managers, businessmen, clients, they understand that. But, you know, in some circumstances, if you're doing evaluation for tax purposes, you can't give them a range. They need a point estimate because Uncle Sam needs a point estimate. That's fair. That's why the why you need the valuation is very important. But if they come to me and they say, hey, they need a valuation for planning and discussion or negotiation, I'll give them a range. I said, look, if you can do this, if you can negotiate up to here, this is a good place to be. If you can negotiate up to here, this is a good place to be.
Okay. One more valuation question then, Bharat. I saw one of your videos was titled, "What's My Personal Brand Worth?" So that made me think it's about number of Twitter followers and my social media standing or something like that. Well, what were you thinking about when you made that one about personal brands?
Nowadays, I get inquiries around, hey, we have an Instagram account with 3 million followers. Can you evaluate? We have a podcast which has, 200,000 downloads a day. Can you evaluate? I'm like, yeah, sure. And really what it translates to is followership, even loyalty or even your recurring revenue. All it is followership. Recurring revenue is just a metric to quantify that followership. Mm-hmm. But if you have a podcast that maybe is not monetized and it has 3 million downloads, say a day, that 3 million downloads, that's quantifiable. Now, who is that worth to, right? Who's going to pay big money for that? And that's, I have to put myself in that buyer's shoe that, hey, if I were Spotify or if I were, Paramount Studios or one of those large production houses that are buying podcasts, what might I think this thing is worth? How can I integrate it within my current portfolio? And that's the thought process you have to give. So really, at the end of the day, in evaluation, you're really valuing a followership, if you will. Right. So why are I'm doing a video right now where I am explaining why all of a sudden celebrity endorsement skyrockets a brand. Nobody had heard of Twitter until Ellen DeGeneres posted something on Twitter, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Ryan Reynolds is now working on a cellular company, cell phone company. What the hell does Ryan Reynolds know about a cellular company, right? I mean, what is that? But, hey, he's running it, right? He sold, I think, a business worth $600 million.
All right.
So there is something to it, even though it might sound ridiculous, but there is something to this. Why do you pay Tom Cruise $20 million for a movie? Because Tom Cruise comes with a followership. Why do you hire Tom Hanks? Because he comes with a followership. Mm-hmm. So celebrity endorsements, they come with a followership. Followers are following that celebrity. Now, that doesn't just have to be the movie business celebrity, right? It could be a sports. I mean, why do you pay Michael Jordan for underwear, right? Because you think, hey, Michael Jordan endorses an underwear. People are going to buy that underwear. That's it. That's followership. That's the branding. That's the loyalty. You know, some people say, oh, I just buy everything Nike. Okay, well, because that person trusts Nike, then that's the followership that you're valuing. Now, once that followership, that loyalty translates into revenue, now we're talking valuation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's flip to the hard assets, Bharat. Part of your fame comes from valuing, or maybe I should say appraising hard assets like the Brooklyn Bridge, Atlanta Airport, and the state of Hawaii. Those are three that I've heard mentioned. So how did that happen? How did you get into that? And tell us a little bit of your story about valuing those famous assets.
They say the best things in life happen to you when you least expect them. Mm-hmm. So I was 23 years old. I'm sitting on my desk, minding my business, pretending to work. And my boss walks over, with a thick proposal, and he says, Rod, we have this proposal. We're going to value the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm like, oh, wow, fantastic. Congratulations. Who's doing it? He's like, you are. Okay. I'm like, Paul, you know I have never valued a bridge in my life. you know that, right? You hired me. And you want me to start with the Brooklyn Bridge? He's like, yes. Like, oh, okay. By the way, and I'm going to give you three guys whom you have to train on the job while you're training yourself. Like, okay. Anything else? Do a good job. And he walks away. And, I figured it out. Again, because I'm one of the very few people in the country who can value oddball assets, things that most people wouldn't know where to start, or they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I have valued those kind of assets, and it requires a very different level of thinking. And by different level, I don't mean very fancy or anything. It really means that I stay grounded. I don't forget where my anchor is. I keep the fundamentals, the basic, always in the foreground. All right. So, you know, the basics of valuations, they don't change, right? I mean, it's the schematics, they might change how you present it, right? I mean, internal combustion engine is the internal combustion engine. Right? Mm-hmm. You could use it to make electricity. You could use it to drive a car. You could use it to drive a bus or motorboat, whatever. It's an internal combustion engine. So that's exactly what it is. I mean, valuation, I stick with the fundamentals. And if it's a bridge or a pipeline or a railroad or a business or a startup, it doesn't matter. I stick with the fundamentals. That's why I'm able to figure out all those assets unique.
What was the why in the case of the Brooklyn Bridge? Why did insurance. Somebody, the city or the state, decide they needed insurance. To have a valuation?
So after 9/11 happened, all these assets were underwritten by Lloyd's of London. So imagine after 9/11 happened, you know, the underwriter at Lloyd's of London is shitting his pants. He's like, oh my God, I might have to pay this out one day. And of course, you know, insurance companies, they're thinking, am I collecting enough premiums? Because if I have to pay this out, I better be collecting enough premium. So to collect enough premium, they need to make sure it's appraised right, get it appraised right. They need to hire people like us to bring in to make sure it's... they're underwriting at the correct valuation.
You mentioned the state of Hawaii. Was that the physical place or was that the government or the administration of the state of Hawaii? What were you valuing?
All the assets owned by the state of Hawaii. So imagine what assets the government owns. Airports, roads, bridges, sidewalks, marinas, breakwalls. I mean, water treatment plants, sewer treatment plants, police stations, fire stations, tunnels. I mean, everything they owned, I have valued each and one of those assets.
Hmm. And was that for the same reason, insurance, or was it for raising finance?
That was for accounting. So if you can imagine, over, say, State of Hawaii was formed, I think, 1859. No, it was later than that. 1949. So over the last, say, 100 years in U.S. presence in Hawaii, right, the taxpayers have spent hundreds of billions of dollars investing into roads, bridges, buildings, creating that sewer infrastructure, wastewater treatment plants, everything in Hawaii, tunnels, everything. And all those assets are written on the state of Hawaii's books under fixed assets category at original cost. So if they built the tunnel for $10 million in 1950, that tunnel is valued as zero in the state of Hawaii's books, because if they were built in the 50s at, say, $10 million, it's also depreciated over time. So now it's worth zero. Book value is zero. But is it worth zero? No, it's worth more than zero. What is it worth? Well, that's what it brought me in.
Well, let's see if we can leave our listeners with some advice, Bharat. Maybe I'm going to ask you an unanswerable question, but let's say I'm a business owner. It's a mature business in the sense of it's 10 or 15 years old. It's got reliable revenue, some growth. It's got profit. I think I might want to sell it in a couple of years' time. And I might be able to either add more input costs, like hire some more people and drive revenue that way, or I might be able to cut input costs and improve my profit margin. I might be able to take on some new innovative investments and add to the portfolio of the business. Can you give direction or suggestions or a way to think about, I'm going to sell my business in 2 or 3 years' time. Here's what I should do now.
Yeah, absolutely. Buyers, as in buyers of businesses, they want to buy businesses where they can enjoy the cash flow without doing anything. So they want to be sitting on the side of a lake and eating bonbons and enjoying the cash flow. That's their thought process, right? Because if they buy something and if they have to put in 80 hours a week, they're buying a job. They're not buying a business. So the question becomes, how do you get your business to become a automated cash cow for the new buyer or for you? You might not want to sell it once you make it an automated cash cow. Mm-hmm. So always think in terms of recurring revenue. I'll give you an example. There's a car wash that I usually go to. And that car wash has this deal where if you pay for 5 car washes up front, you get 1 for free. If you pay for 10, you get 2 for free. They have that deal. And I have one of those coupons, so I just always go there. One time I went there, the line was 8 cars long. So I'm like, all right, I'm not sitting here for an hour and a half. So I went to another car wash, which is a block down. And that car wash was also packed. But I said, okay, fine. I'm just here now, and I'm just going to get my car washed. So I go up to the counter, and she said, sir, are you a member? What? I'm not a member of a car wash. No. How much is a car wash? She's like, oh, $25. I'm like, $25? Car wash? She's like, oh, but if you're a member, it's this price. So what they had was a monthly membership tiers. So if you get 2 car washes a month, it is like $30. If you get 3, it's like $40. If you get unlimited car washes for $50. That is a beautiful business model because irrespective of the customer coming in or not, you're getting your money. Versus the other business model where you're offering a discount, almost a discount, right? 5, you get 1 free, 10, you get 2 free. That's almost a discount. But here, the customer can go unlimited. And who's going to get a car wash more than once a week? But they still get the $50 in their account every month, like a gym. So it's almost like a rental model. And that's the model you want. So if you can convert your paying clients into a monthly recurring model, even if you have to take a hit on your revenue, so say if your revenue is $10 and you have to make your revenue $8 to convert it into a monthly recurring client, do it. Because at $10, I might give you 2x, so your business might be worth 20. But at $8, I might give you 5x. So your business would be worth 40. But this only works if you have enough margin to sustain the decline from 10 to 8. And the second thing, that's one thing. And the second thing, there are only 2 things. I try to keep things simple. How much can you automate your business? Now, most people say, oh, my business can't be automated. I understand. What can be automated about your business? Start with that. Invoices, payroll, receivables, right? Marketing, emails. I mean, start with the things that can be automated. The more automation, the better, because that means a new buyer doesn't need to have that much involvement if things are automated. Or if your business is people heavy, right, have professional services or something, then not everything can be automated, which is also fine. Then what kind of systems and policies do you have in place, processes do you have in place at a human level, which almost makes things automated? Mm-hmm. Do you have scrum meetings? Do you have monthly reports? I mean, what do you have to make a buyer's life easy so that she knows exactly what happened in my business today? Can they get a snapshot, a dashboard of this is where my business is? So two things, recurring revenue and automation.
Good. Amazon calls those mechanisms. They say principles are good. We have a lot of them, but mechanisms are what work. And mechanisms that either automate or systematically help people to follow processes that are good processes. So good. Well, Barrett, thank you very much. You're the expert and you shared some great expertise. I love your stories, and that's actionable advice you gave us at the end. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Hunter. I appreciate you having me.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.